Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. This is a podcast in which we explore the relationship between object and person. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the head of public engagement at the museum. And today my guest is my boss, the director of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, David Ellis. David, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
It's a pleasure, Craig.
I'm actually really looking forward to this one because it's not every day you get to grill your own boss. But I guess, you know, as a director of a cultural institution, can you talk to us a bit more about, you know, what your role is in terms of the Chow Chak Wing Museum? I know within the glam sector, there's a lot of different opinions about what a director does or doesn't do. But from your perspective, how do you see your position within the operation?
My role in the university is Director of Museums and Cultural Engagement. That includes being a line manager for the Seymour Centre, but my day job, as it were, is really director of the university's museum collections, which are now all encompassed in the Chow Chak Wing Museum.
Now, we'll talk more about the museum in a moment, but how long have you been at the University of Sydney?
I've been at the University of Sydney since 2003, when I was appointed as the inaugural Director of Museums and Cultural Engagement. And that was designed to bring together the collections at the museums, the Nicholson Museum, the Maclay Museum, and the University Art Collection, under one cohesive unit.
So the opening of the Chow Chak Wing Museum, which is taking place this month, is really the culmination of those 17 years then?
It is indeed. It is indeed. It's been a wonderful journey to get to this point.
What I think our listeners would be very keen in terms of hearing is what is your vision for the Chow Chak Wing Museum? How do you see it as fitting into the broader cultural sector of Sydney?
The Chow Chak Wing Museum, by bringing all the collections of the Nicholson, the Maclay and the Art Gallery together, open all sorts of new possibilities for learning and engaging with our visitors. Art speaking to science, science speaking to antiquities. It also provides a state-of-the-art environment in which to hold these incredibly important cultural and scientific collections. The right environment, the right security, the right display conditions. And it also doubles or even triples our capacity to show what we've got.
Yeah, I think that's probably, certainly I believe one of the great achievements is there are things in the collection that I've never seen that are now accessible for a much wider audience. And that's so exciting, isn't it?
You know, 70% of what visitors will see in the Chow Chak Wing Museum haven't been seen for at least 20 years, if at all.
Plenty of things to explore.
My word.
Before we go on to talk about the object that you have selected today, could you talk to us a bit more about your career prior to working at the University of Sydney? Because I suspect that within this story, we'll get a sense as to why you've chosen the particular object that you have.
Indeed. The object that I've chosen is intensely intermixed with my journey to where I am now. But I started as an art school student, receiving a Bachelor of Arts in Visual Arts from Tasmania. And, of course, being an art school graduate, there's no clear career path to anything. You carve your own career path. Mm. And through various means, through working for Art Exhibitions Australia on blockbuster exhibitions, Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery as curator of exhibitions, National Library of Australia as director of exhibitions, at Arts New South Wales, looking at policy and grant funding for small museums. That was a pathway that led me to the University of Sydney. Mm. And I'm so glad that I did join the university 2003. It's the highlight, really, of my career.
Excellent. Well, given Object Matters is a podcast about objects, could you tell us what item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection you have chosen today?
I've chosen one of the specimens that is less well known as part of our collections. It's a mineral specimen. It's a mineral specimen called sericite, which is a lead carbonate mineral. It was found in Broken Hill in the 1890s. Being a lead mineral, it's a very heavy specimen, so it'll fit in the palm of your hand. But what really attracts me to this specimen is that it intersects with my own interest in mineralogy, And I've always been interested in mineralogy from high school, mainly because of the aesthetics of crystallized minerals. Not so much of the mineralogy, but the aesthetics and the social history, the journey and the pathways that minerals take through the world before they end up in museums or private collections. So the sericite is a particularly interesting mineral. It's heavy, it's well crystallized, it fits in the palm of my hand. It's a white, silky mineral. It has a very high, what's called a very high dispersion. Diamond has a high dispersion. That's right. What gives it its sparkle. Sericite equally has a nice dispersion, but it's very soft, so it can't be used as a gemstone.
Yeah.
The intersecting crystals are very distinctive. If you show a mineral collector a photograph of a sericite, they'll immediately be familiar with it. That is sericite. They are what we call V-shaped twins. So there's a whole series of V-shaped crystals, and they intersect at a precise and consistent angle throughout the specimen. Mm. And that's really what attracted me to this specimen, as well as it came from Broken Hill. And it was collected in the 1890s at a time just when the mines were opening up. And that top surface of the mines of the lode deposit, it was being mined for zinc, silver, copper, and lead. The top surface was being mined, and that produced a lot of what's called oxidized minerals. So the way the main ore body was being decomposed over long periods of time produced crystallization.
Right.
And one of those minerals that were crystallized was sericite. There was a publican called Edward Aldridge.
There's always a publican.
There's always a publican in mining towns, my word. Edward Aldridge was a well-known publican. He was also a mineral collector. And he used to trade pails of beer for specimens.
Oh, that sounds a fair trade.
Well, yes, it was. And unsurprisingly, he amassed a superb mineral collection. Miners weren't actually allowed to collect minerals, but it was a useful side income for many of them. So there was a thirst throughout the world in the latter part of the 19th century of getting examples of fine minerals or natural history to fill the new museums of the world. Mm. And the Broken Hill suite of minerals were very highly regarded.
Well, I want to return to Broken Hill a little bit later on, and indeed that sense of collecting history. Mm. But I think in terms of the piece that you've chosen, and I must say we're sitting here with an image of it right now, it is stunningly beautiful, isn't it? It's, you know, from an aesthetic perspective, it just jumps out at you.
And as an art school graduate, that's what really attracted me. Mm. Because it can be an odd mix. Art school, graduate science, doesn't always go together. Mm. But it worked for me. And what it did was take me across five continents, countless kilometres, more than 45 years, meeting authors and museum directors and curators and miners, mineral dealers. I've crawled through mines in Arizona, in Tasmania, couriered extraordinary gems from one side of the US to another. On behalf of gem merchants, because 21-year-old kid from Tasmania, people seemed to trust me. They said, "Oh, here, we need you to deliver this little parcel. We'll show you what it is, but it needs to be delivered to Washington next week. Here's your airfare." Mm. And it was great fun.
Of course you'd say yes.
Of course.
I mean, it's interesting, obviously, with your own personal interest in mineralogy, but one thing that I think that many of our listeners and indeed many of our visitors to the Chow Chak Wing Museum would be unaware of is the role of geological specimens within the museum collection. I know that people think of us in terms of antiquities, in terms of art, both historical and contemporary, in terms of natural history, in terms of indigenous and ethnography. But geological specimens is not something which is necessarily at the forefront of people's perceptions of what the Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney's collections might mean. Could you talk a little bit more about, you know, the size of mineral and geological specimens within the collection?
Yeah, part of my role is to identify important scientific and cultural material that might still remain in departmental collections One of those, unsurprisingly, that I investigated were the geoscience collections at the university, the rock and mineral and paleontological collections, the fossil collections. And I was aware that at some time in the university's history, around 1900, that acquired an important mineral collection called the Dixon Collection. And that came during that boom period following the emergence of Broken Hill. Mm. But the first mineral collection that we've since acquired into the collection was brought out to the university in 1866, appointment of A.M. Thompson, who arrived from London to take up his duties as the reader in geology and mineralogy. Because mineralogy was originally taught as a component of a course in natural science. Mm. Geology only became a subject in its own right in about 1875. So we know that A.M. Thompson purchased this collection from a dealer called Gregory, and we've been able to re-piece together his original collection.
Oh, wow.
And they were used to inform students
about
crystallography, about mineralogy at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm conscious of the fact that the academic development of the study in many ways parallels what's happening with archaeology, my own area of study, in a similar time frame and indeed in a similar manner throughout the 19th century, where you're really going from these amateur collectors through to the imposition of quite rigorous academic concepts behind the material being dealt with. Within the broad, I mean, you alluded to earlier the important role of Broken Hill in terms of part of that transition in Australia. But what was the value in the 19th century of specimens such as the cerasite specimen that we're talking about today? Did it have a financial value? Or was
oh,
it more
yes, yeah.
One?
Just like many areas of natural history, they were traded around the world.
Extensive.
There was a vibrant trade. In fact, for example, one collector that's well known in natural history circles, W.F. Pettit, who was collecting natural history birds and animals in the Pacific region, was also amassing a mineral collection in Tasmania.
Mm, right.
And I first came across him when I was curator of exhibitions in the Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery. And he traded suites of a mineral called croquite, which is a lead chromate mineral that was the finest specimens were found in Tasmania.
Yeah.
I also went on to trade croquite throughout the
yes,
world. So there is a tradition there. But they were highly valued.
Mm.
And in return, rather than sell them, he traded with other museums, with other collectors, and amassed a very fine small collection for the Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery.
Right, right.
Likewise, the University of Sydney received a couple of donations, collections. One was purchased by a Mr. Dixon, a suite of Broken Hill specimens. Some of those specimens were purchased purely to trade, to build that collection.
Right.
That didn't actually happen in the end, but that was the original purpose.
Intention. Okay. So bringing back to Broken Hill then, you've got the big boom of the late last decade of the 19th century.
Mm.
And is it a byproduct of the more conventional commercial mining that was taking place, or were they working parallel in terms of this idea of the more specialised collectors?
It really was a byproduct. It was an accident, really. Okay. Miners were often working by hand at that time still. They would uncover what's called vugs, openings in the ground full of crystallized minerals. If the shift boss was looking the other way, they'd quickly go into a lunch pail.
Yeah, right.
Whatever they could take out.
Yeah, okay.
Or sometimes an engineer would close down that section and gather it all for themselves.
Yeah, okay.
Because they knew there was a trade. They knew there was a thirst of it. And buyers would come from around the world and contact miners.
Mm.
They'd travel around the world and then ship them to their other sources throughout the world and continue that trade.
The trade. It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary because the cerasite that I've chosen is actually a fragile mineral.
Mm.
It's brittle.
Mm.
If you drop it, it'll shatter like glass. So what's extraordinary that these beautiful crystals were extracted relatively undamaged from deep within a mine, went to a mine, into a lunch pail,
got carried out,
traded over the pub counter, probably, were carried out, traded over the pub counter, were purchased by another party, transported to, in this case, Sydney, and then in the hands of students over a hundred years, survived. Remarkable.
Yeah. Did much of the Broken Hill material end up in Sydney, or was it really going all over the place?
There were buyers from London, there were buyers from Germany, and the USA that were all had agents in Broken Hill.
Right, okay.
And shiploads would go out. Yeah. In fact, Dixon purchased the collection at first for it to go to Chicago at one of the big exhibitions in Chicago.
Yes.
That, for whatever reason, that didn't happen.
Yeah, right.
And he decided to give the collection. The main bulk went to the University of Sydney. Some went to the School of Mines in Sydney, and the remainder went to the Australian Museum.
Right, okay. That's a really interesting object history in terms of, in a sense, where the accidental recipients of this particular piece then.
It was more than accidental, actually. Dixon saw the power of building up the geology department. Remember, this was at a time Archibald Liversidge was professor up until 1893, but then it went into a real heyday with appointment of Edgeworth David as professor of geology.
Yes.
Now, Edgeworth David went on to train such famous geologists as Sir Douglas Mawson, Leo Cotton, Griffith Taylor,
C.E.
Tilley, common names in the history of geology and geography. And he also influenced by their contact with people like Sam Carey, who was working down in Tasmania through the 1940s, 50s. And that long association with these big names lasted right up until his death in the 1930s. It was the first department of geology, and it was one of the most influential departments.
Yes. And certainly in terms of the impact on the broader Australian economy, the broader Australian
cultural, which
we're still living with the legacy of in the 21st century, aren't we?
So that first reader of geology came out in 1866. So that was just after the gold boom. And there was a lot of mining, exploration going on in those intervening years. So there seemed to be a need to train up geologists, to train up people that can identify economically important lodes and ores.
You're listening to Object Matters. For this episode, I'm interviewing David Ellis, the director of the Chow Chek Wing Museum. David, can you tell me what meaning does this particular specimen have for you personally?
When I saw this suite of sericites, and I've chosen what I think is one of the best out of that suite, it just brought back memories. Because one of the people that really influenced me in my mineral collecting was a person called Albert Chapman. Now, many people familiar with the Australian Museum would recognise that name because there was the Chapman Gallery and the Chapman Mineral Collection. Well, Chappie, as he was called, really, really helped me lift my sights on quality collecting, and introduced me to all manner of people across the world, eminent curators, eminent museum directors, and they all very generously opened their doors.
Right. Do you still collect today, personally, or...?
Oh, yes, but it's changed. It's now become a commodity that is far beyond my reach normally. Very fine specimens go for huge amounts.
So the value is changed considerably.
Yeah.
One thing that I always find interesting, and I've asked this of some of the people who've been on this program, but in terms of that ongoing relationship that we have with an object or with a specimen in this case, do you find that the way that you respond to it today has changed from the way that you did the very first time you saw it? Do you remember the very first time you saw it?
Yes, I did. And I thought, I've got to spend more time in this collection because heaven, really. It was wonderful. I'd spend most of my lunch times over quite a few months down there, just working through getting to understand the collection, getting to understand what we should be taking into the Chow Chek Wing Museum and what might be left with geosciences for ongoing student use.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed. I still get a thrill out of seeing good, fine mineral specimens.
Now, the question I'm asking everyone who appears on this program, and it's stumping some people, but others are loving it, but if you could choose one word, in one word, what does this particular piece mean to you?
It's really about memory. Yeah, it takes me back to when I first met Albert Chapman.
Yeah.
And I bought a cerasite from Albert Broken Hill. So it was one of those early purchases. Yeah. Actually, I traded it with him for a good Craigwhite specimen. And I've still got it.
Fantastic. Now, is the specimen going to be on public display in the Chowchacka Wing Museum at opening?
Eventually it will be.
Yeah. I know it's in, and this is where we can do the ad as well, but I know that it's actually in the book that you've written, the catalogue.
Yes, it's one of the 36 specimens that I've chosen for the Scala series, international series called Director's Choice, and that's just been published. Yeah. To commemorate the opening of the Chowchacka Wing Museum. Yes,
I know I'm biased, but it is actually a beautiful publication, so well done, David.
Thank you.
But when it is on public display, what would you like visitors to think about when they get a chance to see it?
Its journey. Something that came from deep underground, formed countless eons ago. It's fragile, it's beautiful. What was its journey? From the mine, deep underground, to where it is now.
Today.
Every mineral has a social history.
Yeah, yes. And a lovely chance within the museum context to actually explore that relationship as well, too. Mm. That's, you know, its impact upon the way that a society thinks about it or responds to it or interacts with it.
Mm. Yes.
Going from that one specimen to the Chowchacka Wing Museum as an entire entity. As we record this, we are only a couple of days away from opening. I think we're both quite exhausted from, and yet exhilarated from everything that's happening. By the time this is live, we will be open. In terms of visitors coming to see the museum, you know, in your final words for this podcast, what do you want people to get out of the experience? What do you want the Chowchacka Wing Museum to become?
It's an exciting time because we're creating a museum that really has something for everyone. And the juxtapositions are sometimes quite surprising. It's the ancient world meeting science, arts, visual arts. It's that juxtaposition, sometimes surprising, where different conversations start to happen.
Yes. Yeah.
Different threads start to emerge where you wouldn't normally imagine those threads to be.
Yeah.
Find the unexpected.
Yes, find the unexpected. David, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real privilege from my perspective to see your passion, but to also see a part of the collection that I personally don't know a great deal about. But I look forward to discovering more through the specimens that are going to be displayed both at opening and in coming years. Thank you for coming in and sharing your interest and sharing your knowledge.
Thanks, Greg.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chowchacka Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pay our respect to the traditional owners. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchacka Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.